Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Episode 31, Rigorous and Laxus. By late 250 AD, the Decian persecution, while still officially going on, had relaxed enough, at least in North Africa, for the church to operate somewhat more freely.
As we saw last episode, a major rift had occurred in the Western Church over how to deal with the lapsed who wanted to return to communion. Some favored a lax attitude towards apostasy, accepting the letters of absolution from the confessors and calling for immediate reconciliation. Hence, this group is dubbed the Laxus. On the other side were the rigorous, people like Cyprian and even more so Novatian, who said the lapsed needed to be penitent and could not be readmitted immediately. Once God had granted peace to the whole church and the persecution had ended, a policy of how to reconcile the lapsed could be determined. In an attempt to regain control of the Carthaginian church, Cyprian established a commission in January 251, consisting of clergy loyal to him. In a politically apt move, Cyprian actually appointed three new presbyters from among the Carthaginian confessors, thereby combining their moral authority with his own authority as bishop. This new commission was to take charge of the Church of Carthage on Cyprian's behalf, appoint loyal clergy who would not give in to the demands of the lapsed, and follow Cyprian's directives. The result was a schismatic Laxus faction led by the deacon Felicissimus. Felicissimus gathered to his side not only countless lapsed who rejected Cyprian's policy, but also the five presbyters who had originally opposed Cyprian's appointment to the episcopate. Among these five presbyters was a certain Novatus, who will become an important political player later on. The confrontation between Cyprian's commission and the Laxus party resulted in the mutual excommunication of each side by the other. By late March of 251, the Decian persecution had effectively ended, and popular anti-Christian sentiment had greatly subsided. At long last, Cyprian was able to return to Carthage, shortly after Easter. Upon his return, the bishop's first priority was to decide just what exactly needed to be done concerning the lapsed. In April, a council was held in Carthage, the first of what would eventually be seven councils over which Cyprian presided. Finally, the church could come together and officially meet and determine what pastoral policy would be. At the council, Cyprian's treatise, On the Lapsed, was read aloud, and his thoughts on the issue laid out. The council came to the following conclusions. The certified, those who had not sacrificed, but had obtained a government libellus, could be readmitted immediately, provided that they had been doing penance. Those who had actually offered sacrifice to the Roman gods were to remain penitent, and only granted communion on their deathbed. Thus, the council moderated Cyprian's earlier, more rigorous views by making a distinction between the certified lapsed and the sacrifice lapsed. The Bishop of Carthage in turn thus shifted his own position accordingly to adopt this middle way of reconciliation. In addition to establishing pastoral policy, the First Council of Carthage also formally excommunicated Felicissimus, Novatus, and the schismatic Laxus clergy. So while a formal policy was now in place, the Laxus schism was, unsurprisingly, not healed. The leaders of the Laxus party did not take their excommunication lying down. They also gained more clerical supporters for their cause. The disgraced former bishop Privatus of Lambesis joined their ranks, along with other disgraced bishops who had themselves lapsed during the persecution and or were personal enemies of Cyprian. So while many joined the Laxus cause out of personal antipathy for Cyprian, they were not wholly lacking in theological conviction. Both sides agreed that salvation did not exist outside the church. Thus, to prevent the lapsed sacrificers from receiving communion until they were about to die could jeopardize their salvation. What if they died before they could receive communion one last time? While it's possible God might forgive them after death, they were ultimately dying outside the church. Therefore, the Laxus saw Cyprian's position as pastoral malpractice, which endangered the souls of the lapsed, and usurped God's role as judge. In addition to dealing with their own schism, the Council of Carthage received the distressing news that another schism was brewing in the Church of Rome. Only this schism resulted in the opposite kind of faction breaking from the church. This schism was centered around none other than Novatian. Novatian was born probably around 200 AD. He was a Roman by background and likely received a standard classical education during his upbringing. It is possible that as a young man he had been a teacher of classical rhetoric and philosophy. During his catechumenate under Bishop Fabianus, Novatian postponed his baptism, probably with the intention of being baptized after he had retired from his public career. But then Novatian came down with a sudden illness, which seemed fatal, prompting him to make that final step and be baptized. Novatian recovered from his illness, and afterwards decided to devote himself wholeheartedly to serving the church. It was not long before Fabianus ordained him a presbyter. Novatian then quickly rose to become the premier theologian of the Roman Church, and indeed, one of the best early Latin theologians of Christianity. Novatian's skill as a theologian perhaps earned him the moniker the Master of Doctrine, a title his critics would later use with derision, but possibly originally meant as a genuine commendation. Novatian's magnum opus was his book On the Trinity, which proved to be one of the best orthodox treatments of Christology and Trinitarianism in the pre-Nicene Church. Novatian was combating many of the heresies we've already discussed, Docetism, Adoptionism, and Modalism. He was particularly concerned to hold the orthodox view of the Incarnation over against these other teachings. The incarnate Son of God was truly man and truly God. Yet how could God suffer, die, and experience all the limitations of human nature? For Novatian, the solution came from his exegesis of chapter 2 of Paul's epistle to the Philippians. Philippians 2, 6-11 is actually the earliest extant Christian hymn to Jesus, predating Paul's own ministry. Novatian focused on the concept of kenosis, or Christ's self-emptying of divinity upon becoming human. Novatian argued that Christ retained his divinity while experiencing true and limiting humanity by self-limiting his use of his divine powers and authority, i.e. omnipotence, omnipresence, etc. The Son, as consubstantial with God the Father, still retains all his powers, but temporarily abstains from using them, therefore allowing himself to become truly human in every way, ultimately experiencing death on the cross. Another aspect of Novatian's Christology was his recognition of the crucial concept of the eternal generation of the Son from the Father. Although Origen is usually credited with being the first theologian to recognize this critical doctrine, some scholars actually think that it is Novatian to whom the credit is due. Novatian was also ahead of his time in another aspect of Christology. He is perhaps the first theologian to anticipate the doctrine of the communicatio idiomatum, or the teaching that the two natures in Christ communicate attributes to one another, i.e., the divine nature deifies the flesh and raises it to life, while the human nature allows the whole divine person to experience human limitations. Whatever else may be said about Novatian, there can be no doubt that he belongs among the great theologians of the pre-Nicene Church. However, despite all this, it is not for his theological brilliance that Novatian is primarily remembered. Rather, it is for the rigorous, schismatic church which he founded by becoming the second anti-pope of the Roman Church. See, while Cyprian may have had rigorous leanings, he was willing to temper them and even adjust his views, as he did at the First Council of Carthage. But Novatian was of a different sort. By far more a theologian and a scholar than a pastor, Novatian held to a staunch rigorism that even Cyprian would find unacceptable. So long as the persecution was going on, Novatian was content to pay lip service to the possibility of eventually reconciling the lapsed. But in reality, Novatian believed that because apostasy was the unforgivable sin, the church could not readmit the lapsed. Perhaps God might after death, but the church certainly could not. In this way, Novatian's concern was the exact opposite of that of the Laxus. Whereas the Laxus did not want to assume God's role to judge, Novatian did not want to usurp God's role to forgive. Whereas the Laxus wanted to be recognized as part of the Catholic Church, Novatian believed that if lapsed persons were readmitted, the church would lose its essential holiness and purity, and thereby would no longer be the true church. This begs the question which ultimately lay at the heart of the laxist rigorous divide. Is the Christian church a hospital full of imperfect sinners, or a city on a hill comprised of holy and pure saints? By March of 251, peace had sufficiently returned to the Church of Rome, and at long last, after an interval of 14 months with no bishop, a successor to the martyred Fabianus could be elected to the See of Peter. Naturally, many expected Novatian would be chosen. He had, after all, been acting bishop for over a year, and had the firm support of the Roman confessors. But his intense rigorism did not endear him to many others. And so, another presbyter was chosen, Cornelius. Cornelius, in direct contrast to Novatian, advocated a more lenient policy towards the lapsed. Among his first acts as bishop was the reconciliation of an entire group of lapsed Christians. The details of what happened next are sketchy, but the rigorous members of the Roman Church, especially the confessors, ordained Novatian Bishop of Rome in opposition to Cornelius. Both the camps of Cornelius and Novatian provided different stories of what exactly happened in Rome in March of 251. In Cornelius's account, Novatian's deathbed baptism was the result of demonic possession which required an exorcism. His faith was not pure, and everyone in Rome had been opposed to Fabianus's decision to ordain him a presbyter. During the Decian persecution, Novatian did not perform his duties as presbyter out of fear of the authorities. Novatian's election was the result of three bishops who had been filled with alcohol and performed the ordination under duress. Cornelius even claimed one of them reported this to him with tears in his eyes. In Novatian's account, the episcopal election had been undertaken too swiftly, before all the clergy could arrive in Rome. Cornelius was not only in communion with bishops who were known apostates, but also that Cornelius himself had obtained a government libellus during the persecution. Finally, Novatian's own election had been unexpectedly forced upon him, and he only accepted the bishopric reluctantly, at the urging of the confessors and the people. Obviously, both sides mixed whatever the truth was with a fair amount of gossip and slander. There may be some truth to the claim that the election was undertaken without all the usual clergy present, but it does seem clear that Cornelius's election was ultimately viewed as legitimate by the wider Italian church. Novatian's claim about Cornelius being in communion with apostates is obviously just a criticism of Cornelius's lenient policies. Novatian's own consecration as bishop was probably a combination of his own actions and that of others, mainly the confessors of the Roman Church. Although, interestingly enough, we do know that one of the clergymen who instigated Novatian's consecration was Novatus of Carthage, the Laxus presbyter and enemy of Cyprian. Why a Laxist would suddenly turn around and join up with a rigorist is not at all clear. Although both men were ecclesiastical rebels, in the sense of being at odds with the official bishop of their respective churches. The rest of the accounts provided by Cornelius and Novatian's respective camps are almost certainly full of it. The charge that Cornelius obtained a libellus would later be proven false, and the idea that Novatian essentially drugged bishops to ordain him is clearly an invented charge intended to discredit him. Nevertheless, both sides sent messengers and envoys to Carthage, as well as to Alexandria and Antioch in the east. We'll focus on the Eastern churches next episode. For now, we'll contain ourselves to how the rival messengers from Rome were received in Carthage. The chronology of what happened next is a bit confused, but it appears that while the Council of Carthage was in session, word reached them of the disputed episcopal election in Rome, prompting the Africans to dispatch their own representatives to investigate. Meanwhile, messengers from both Cornelius and Novatian arrived in Carthage and presented their case to the African bishops. Cyprian and his fellow Africans, however, declined to declare their support for either side until their own representatives had returned from Rome with their report. This all took place over the course of a couple months, and it wasn't until June that Cyprian and the African bishops confirmed their support for Cornelius over Novatian. Although Cornelius was no doubt happy to have the support of Africa, he was clearly irritated with Cyprian for having taken so long to declare his support for the true Bishop of Rome. As a result, relations between Rome and Carthage were cool due to the lingering uneasiness between Cyprian and Cornelius. The following year, when the Laxus party in Africa was once again rejected by the Second Council of Carthage, they dispatched Philosimus to Rome to gain approval. Cornelius actually allowed the Laxus to present their case before the clergy of Rome, before finally rejecting them. A clear retaliation for Cyprian's reluctance to support his claim to the See of Peter. Now, to be fair, it's not as though Cyprian deliberately snubbed Cornelius. He was just concerned to side with the correct bishop. After all, both Cornelius' messengers and the Novatian envoys provided him with highly biased accounts of the disputed election. How else was Cyprian supposed to know which side was correct without some kind of independent investigation? The relationship between Cornelius and Cyprian may also have been strained by the two men's opposite leanings when it came to the issue of the lapsed. Cyprian leaned towards a more rigorous view and was thus closer in thought to Novatian. Cornelius leaned towards a more lax view and was thus closer in thought to Cyprian's enemies. But in May of 251, a council in Rome under Cornelius confirmed a policy towards the lapsed which matched that of Carthage. Thus, the churches of Italy and Africa had now come to similar conclusions on pastoral policy. Cornelius did, however, make two exceptions. A bishop named Trophimus had led his entire congregation into sacrificing during the Decian persecution. The Bishop of Rome readmitted all of them into communion immediately, on the condition that Trophimus was readmitted as a layman. The second exception Cornelius made were the Roman confessors who had originally sided with Novatian 2 months earlier. Either because they sincerely felt Cornelius was in the right, or they could just see which way the winds were blowing, many of the Roman confessors who had supported Novatian defected en masse to Cornelius. Cornelius in turn allowed them into communion with himself immediately, and did not require either penance or public admonishment. Despite the lingering tension between the bishops of Rome and Carthage, Cornelius and Cyprian did manage to solidify their alliance against Novatian. While Novatian threatened the unity of the Roman Church in a local way, Cyprian viewed his schism as a threat to the unity of the great church as a whole. In order to refute the Novatians, Cyprian penned what is perhaps his most famous treatise, On the Unity of the Catholic Church. It was in this text which Cyprian most fully expressed his views on church government and what constituted the basis for Catholic unity. For Cyprian, the Church Catholic was composed of brother bishops, each sovereign and archpastor in his own region. All bishops inherited the apostolic authority to bind and loose, to retain and readmit sins in God's name, and each individual bishop was accountable directly to God. The main symbol of this episcopal unity was Peter, the prince of the apostles. In Cyprian's exegesis of Matthew 16, Peter is the rock, the foundation upon which the church is built, and hence, the bishop inherits this authority. Furthermore, Cyprian also acknowledged the unique manifestation of Peter's authority in the bishops of Rome, and in chapter 4 of On Unity, he showers praise on the Roman See, no doubt to the pleasure of Cornelius. He even goes so far as to speak of a primacy accorded to the Roman bishop among the other bishops of the great church. As we shall see in a later episode, Cyprian's eventual conflict with another bishop of Rome would cause him to mollify his views on the Roman bishopric, resulting in him rewriting chapter 4 of On Unity and removing his mention of Roman primacy. Cyprian's view of church unity centered on the bishops fueled his desire to refute the Novatians. By setting up rival bishops, the Novatians were striking right at the heart of Christian unity, and in so doing, endangering the souls of the people under their spiritual authority. There was no salvation outside the bounds of the Catholic Church. The Christian Church was like Noah's Ark. The only way to escape the waters of sin and death was to be aboard that ship. One of Cyprian's most famous statements was that you cannot have God as your father without the church as your mother. The two were inseparable. And the Novatians were seriously threatening to separate many from their heavenly father by cutting them off from their ecclesiastical mother. While all this was going on, a fairly momentous event occurred on the Balkan frontier of the Roman Empire. The Church of Rome had been able to elect a new bishop in March 251 because, in part, the Emperor Decius departed from the capital around that time. Decius set off from Rome with his son and co-emperor Herennius to drive back a large army of Goths who had invaded the empire. This invasion was to prove the first of many Gothic incursions into the empire over the crisis of the 3rd century. By the summer of 251, Decius and Herennius were campaigning against the Goths in the Balkans. The details of these battles do not concern us, but the end result of this campaign was to prove disastrous for the Romans. First Herennius, and then Decius himself, died in battle against the Goths, becoming the first emperors in Roman history to fall in battle against a foreign enemy. The remnants of the imperial army proclaimed the local governor, Gaius Vibius Trebonianus Gallus, the new emperor. Gallus was forced to sign a humiliating peace treaty with the barbarians, allowing them to leave the empire with all their loot, and requiring the Romans to pay the Goths annual tribute. Gallus then set off for Rome to secure his reign. The fact that Decius, the first Roman emperor to launch an empire-wide persecution of Christianity, was also the first emperor to die in battle against barbarians, was not lost on early Christian writers, who would go on to paint the emperor's fate as divine vengeance for attacking God's people. Before the decade is out, the Emperor Valerian will launch the second empire-wide persecution, only to suffer a similarly humiliating fate of being the first Roman emperor to be captured alive by foreign enemies. Another shocking event interpreted by early Christians as clear evidence of God's judgment. But that is for another day. When Gallus arrived in Rome, the city, and much of the empire, was already suffering from a new epidemic which had broken out, the Cyprian Plague. Though Gallus and his own heir, Volusianus, managed to escape the disease, the last known son of Decius probably did not. Hostilian was made Augustus by the Senate when word reached them of his father and brother's demise. Gallus, in the interest of avoiding civil war, accepted the young man as his imperial colleague. But the house of Decius did not survive long, and in autumn 251, Hostilian died, most likely of the plague of Cyprian. As you no doubt have guessed, The Cyprian Plague is so named because Cyprian described its effects, most notably in his treatise on mortality. Another detailed account of the plague comes from Cyprian's deacon, Pontius, who wrote a biographical speech of his bishop a year after Cyprian's death. The plague was merciless in Roman Africa, striking down pagan and Christian alike and turning normal society upside down. Many Christians felt it was unjust that they too had to suffer along with their pagan neighbors. Had they not just been through a terrible persecution, and now God was laying this on them? Cyprian sought to reassure his flock. He reminded them that death was not the end, and that paradise was the true home of all Christians. Possibly dying of a plague did not rob one of a noble death like the martyr's crown. He also interpreted the plague as a possible portent of the coming apocalypse. After all, the Lord had predicted persecution and plague would precede his return, did he not? Cyprian even claimed that he received prophetic visions from God concerning the plague. Prophecy and visions were a fairly regular part of Cyprian's ministry throughout his life. The possibility of the impending end of the world should be of comfort to Christians, since they are justified before God. In the meantime, there was still opportunity to do good works and serve one's neighbor. The bishop led his church by example in offering alms, charity, and aid to all people affected by the plague, regardless of religious creed. The reaction of many of the local pagans in Carthage to the epidemic was hardly surprising. This plague had been brought upon them by the immortal gods. A local edict was issued in Carthage in April 252, ordering public sacrifices be made to appease the divinities. Naturally, this local edict came into conflict with Christian prohibitions against idolatry, just as Decius's edict had 2 years earlier. Anti-Christian sentiment began to rise. Pagans began blaming them for the plague as they had done in Tertullian's day. Combined with the Christian refusal to sacrifice in defiance of the local edict, the stage was set for potential pogroms and persecution. There was even fear that the new emperor Gallus would return to Decius's anti-Christian policies. Whether or not Gallus was actually contemplating launching another imperial persecution, both the scapegoating caused by the plague and the edict were enough to convince Cyprian that more persecution was on its way, even if his charity work had managed to mollify the pagan hostility. So on May 15th, 252, Cyprian held his second Council of Carthage, composed of 42 bishops. At the council, Cyprian and his colleagues made the pastoral decision to readmit all the lapsed. All the Christians who desired to return to communion, who had lapsed under Decius, were allowed to return to the fold. Despite the hardline stance which Cyprian had displayed in his views on the lapsed, he was ultimately the chief pastor for the Christians of Roman Africa, and the care of their souls was his sacred duty. If another persecution came, and the lapsed Christians felt they had no hope of returning to the church, what was to prevent them from just sacrificing again, or giving up on Christianity forever? Finally, on top of all this, was the Cyprian plague itself, which was bringing many lapsed Christians straight to death's door. And so, Cyprian and his synod made the pastoral decision to allow everyone to come back into communion, in firm rejection of the rigorism of the Novatians. In addition, the attempts of the Laxus party to be reconciled were once again denied by the council. In retaliation, the leaders of both the Laxus and the Novatians consecrated rival bishops of Carthage. The Laxus were now completely undermined. Cyprian allowed the lapsed laity back into communion, but the Laxus clergy were still on the outs and excommunicated from the Catholic Church. The Novatians, on the other hand, had come to completely disavow all other Catholic churches not in communion with them, and so regarded Cyprian and his colleagues as outside the true church. His reconciliation of the lapsed only serving to add further proof to his impurity. Therefore, a bishop from the Church of the Pure, that's what the Novatians called themselves, was needed to serve the real Christians who still remained in Carthage. Lexus appointed Fortunatus, one of the original presbyters who had opposed Cyprian, while the Novatians consecrated Maximus, a Roman presbyter who had sided with Novatian from the beginning. Two anti-bishops, against whom Cyprian had to defend his position. Just like that, Cyprian found himself in the same situation Cornelius had a year earlier, only with two rather than one episcopal pretenders. But unlike Cornelius, Cyprian's position was stronger. He had, after all, been the recognized bishop of Carthage for about 4 years at this point, and he commanded, by far, the vast majority of the support of the African, Numidian, and Mauritanian clergy. Rival bishops were not Cyprian's main concern at this point. Rather, it was the very real possibility of a renewed persecution. Fears of another imperial persecution were seemingly confirmed a year later when, in June of 253, Gallus had Cornelius and many other Roman clergy exiled to a small town north of Rome. The physical stress of this exile proved too much for Cornelius, and he died. Shortly thereafter, one of the presbyters who had been exiled with him, Lucius, was able to return to Rome and was consecrated bishop on June 25th. We cannot be sure that these exiles constituted the beginning of another persecution, because in less than 2 months, Gallus would die in another Roman civil war. Perhaps it was the infighting between Cornelius and Novatian's camps which caused the emperor to order the exile. Novatian himself was likely among the group of Roman clergy who were exiled. Dionysius of Alexandria perceived Gallus to be a nascent persecutor, referring to the banishment of holy men as evidence. If these holy men were Cornelius and his presbyters, then it seems more likely that their exile was a local issue, not representative of an emerging imperial policy. Whatever the case, by August of 253, Gallus was dead, and Lucius had returned to Rome as a confessor for the faith. With that, we will leave Cyprian and his Western colleagues. Next episode, we will head back to the Eastern Mediterranean and see how the Christians of Egypt, the Levant, and Anatolia are dealing with not only the lapsed and the Novatians, but also foreign invasion as the Roman frontiers continue to be breached by barbarians in the crisis of the Third Century.